Hello and welcome to a brand new season of Inside Education, the program and podcast for teachers, policymakers, and anyone with an interest in the how, what, and why of teaching and learning. We have a brand new theme tune composed specially for the program by David Vesey. And I have an interesting schedule of programmes planned for the coming 9 months or so. And I hope you can join me for insights, stimulating ideas and a one-stop shop for professional development for all educators. I'm Sean Delaney and you can download podcasts of previous editions by going to seandelaney.com. That's D-E-L-A-N-E-Y with two E's and clicking on podcasts. This week, we find out more about school gardens and garden-based learning with scientist and horticulturalist Sandra Austin. She has wide experience as a scientist, a gardener, a researcher, and an educator. Sandra Austin currently teaches social, scientific, and environmental education at the Merino Institute of Education in Dublin. When we spoke, I first asked Sandra how she became interested in school gardens.
I come from a very unusual background in that initially I was working as a scientist for about 15 years and then I decided to do something different and I went back and I retrained as a horticulturist. And through that, through working as a gardener and working as a horticulturist, because of the places I was working, one was the Eden Project in Cornwall and one was back here with an adult learning programme, I moved from horticulture into education. So for me, the two are kind of inextricably linked. So the idea of educating people using a garden, I find very, very natural, pardon the pun, a very natural fit. So when I came back to teaching in primary education or in primary teacher education, it seemed natural for me to want to include those aspects in the way that I approach my teaching of science education and geography education, particularly.
And what was the transition like from being a scientist to being a horticulturalist?
There was actually a lot more overlap than I had thought there would be. So one of the reasons I had moved from science, it wasn't that I didn't enjoy doing science. I'm naturally a very curious person or nosy person, I suppose. But I got really tired of working in a lab all the time. And so you'd be indoors, you wouldn't know whether it was day or night or if it was raining or whatever. So I had felt very disconnected. And the nice thing about moving into horticulture was that you're very connected with the world around you, with the natural world. And so I could still put my curiosity to use. There was still lots of questions I had, still lots of things that I was observing and analysing, but I was able to do that in connection with the natural environment. I found that really therapeutic, actually. And I think that's one of the reasons why I'm so keen to see that being part of everyday classroom life. The idea that your classroom isn't just the four walls, it can be the outdoors as well. There's an outdoor classroom just waiting to be explored as well.
And I want to get to that in a moment, but if I could ask you, first of all, was the science discipline you were most involved in biology?
It was biology. So I had studied in Trinity College. Their science programme is lovely in that it's a very broad programme when you start out. You don't have to choose until the end of your second year what you're going to specialise in. But I specialised in biology, but I went for microbiology. So I went for a lab-based science. I could have done botany, actually, at that point. It's funny how your life has all these different forks and that inevitably sometimes those roads turn back on themselves. So I had decided not to do botany and I had decided to go into microbiology. But actually, as I said, there's loads of overlap.
And what do children learn from being involved with a school garden?
That's a question that I ask teachers all the time, because my background, although I'm in teacher education, I've never worked as a primary teacher. And I'm very clear, you know, that I have a lot to learn from teachers who are working in that context. So I ask teachers all the time, what do they see children learning? And what they tell me, and what you can see actually in the literature around garden-based learning, is it affects all parts of children's development. So their academic development, their learning across the different subjects. So you can learn maths in a garden, you can learn science, you can learn history. You're seeing development and change all the time. But also children learn how to work together, work cooperatively. Children feel that achievement of success. So in terms of their social development, their personal development, there's a lot that they're learning all the time.
And you even mentioned a therapeutic value.
Yes, and that's something that came out very strongly when I was talking to teachers recently around Dublin. I was talking to 6 different schools, and in each of those schools, they had very different gardens. But each of the teachers I spoke to talked about the children that they have in their classes who may struggle. They might have behavioural difficulties, or they might have special educational needs around that, and they may need to take time out. And their gardens, they use them a lot for just the children to go out into the garden and have a bit of quiet time. One of the teachers I was talking to recently spoke about a girl with autism who she works with, and who is a brilliant bird watcher, or knows everything there is to know about all the different kinds of birds. So she might come and she might be very distressed, or she might have had an incident in the classroom, or she's not happy, but she'll come and sit in the garden, and within minutes you can just see all that stress flowing out of her, and she's recognising birds and she's telling you about the different birds. And that's just a lovely thing to hear, you know, just these little moments. And each of the teachers I spoke to had children that really benefited from that, or children that might feel a little bit isolated in the classroom or having issues around that kind of social integration, that actually, again, the garden is somewhere where they can feel that sense of connection or feel that sense of healing, or where they might be the expert. You know, maybe they're not the high achievers in the classroom, but bring them outside and then all of a sudden their skills or their expertise becomes something that the other children are keen to learn from.
And how do teachers use the gardens in your experience? In other words, would they bring out a full class, or is it more for individuals, or would it be more for groups?
I have seen all of those things, so across the spectrum, from full classes, which does take a bit of management. When teachers take children out as a full class, it really helps if there's another adult with you. So whether you can pull in one of your classroom assistants or a parent or a grandparent, it really works best when there's a couple of adults if you're going to take out a full class. Or often what happens is perhaps a classroom teacher working in conjunction with a teacher in learning support, that there may be small groups taken out at a time and worked with. Or again, there might be individuals that just come out with their own classroom assistant or their special needs assistant, that they would bring them out if they needed movement breaks or things like that.
If you're going to be there with a whole class, it sounds as if you'd need a pretty big garden. Would that be right?
No, not necessarily. I mean, as long as you have a space that the children will fit, particularly when you're working with the whole class, it's really important to do something like that regularly so that the children get used to the routine of it and they know kind of the boundaries of what they can do and where they can go. But gardens don't need to be big spaces. People think you need a lot of natural environment. You can do an awful lot in tubs and baskets and growing up along a wall. It doesn't have to be a big space.
What different kinds of gardens have you observed in schools as you have been doing your research?
The answer again is that it's very variable. So I have seen everything from a couple of tubs at the classroom door and some pots hanging, and it can be that small, and there's a lot to be learned from that.
And you still call that a garden?
And I would still call that a garden. If there's something growing in it, it's a garden. And even, you know, you see so many teachers growing things on windowsills. So it's only a small step to take it from the windowsill into a pot just outside the door, some pots outside the door. I was in a school recently where they have tyres. It's a rural school, so they have access to lots of tractor tires and things like that, and that's what they grow in. There may be 2 or 3 on the ground, or they may stack them. They actually had painted them to look like a minion. Are you a fan of the minions?
Well, I know what they are.
Yes. So they had a minion, which is where they grew their potatoes, because that is a nice deep thing, and then you can just take your tires off one by one and look at your potatoes growing all the way down through the soil, which is really interesting.
That's clever.
A lot of gardens that are just a small space out at the back of the school. There are a number of different organisations. Bord Bia ran a programme recently where they supplied you with a couple of raised beds, the planks and the soil. The Irish Register of Herbalists also have what they call the Herb Patch Project. They provide you with a 1 metre square set of boards and the soil to fill them in, and 9 different herbs to put in there. So that's a 1 metre square garden that you can work with. And then I was in another school where they have like about a 1/2 acre at the back. So they have woodland and they have a pond and they have a garden. And I think that's your grand deluxe penthouse. But a couple of schools I've been to recently don't have a garden as such, but they have a polytunnel, which is in some ways is even better because it's weatherproof. And one of the schools I spoke to, they had won their polytunnel in an incredible edibles competition. So actually that is a real connecting factor between all of the schools I talk to on a regular basis. They know how to enter competitions and win prizes and win these things. There was another school I spoke to recently in the north side of the city, and they had won a Spirit of Dublin award from the local authority, and they're putting that money into building an outdoor classroom, which is essentially sticking a couple of whiteboards against the wall of the school and putting in some logs as seating areas and then some planters for planting in.
And if you walked into a school and, you know, wherever it is, whether it's in the country or in the city, and they don't have a school garden, where would you start, or where would you advise somebody to start if they kind of think, yeah, look, it's something I might be interested in, but there's nothing here at the moment?
And that's a fair point, that people are put off by the idea that it will take a lot of work and it takes a lot of space. So my advice is always start small. So start with your pots on the windowsill. I think most teachers are doing that anyway. And think about, could I put maybe one bed outside? Could we have like that herb patch project bed and work with maybe one group of children or one class? Start small. Start with things that are easy, or what I would call bomb proof. So growing potatoes is usually fairly straightforward. Putting some bulbs in the ground is a great way to get started, or putting bulbs in pots is a great way to get started. Interestingly, growing fruit and vegetables is a little trickier because the school year runs until the end of June, and then just when everything is about to burst into flower and fruit, everybody goes home for the summer and you don't see it. So it can take a little bit of thinking about what do you want to grow. I would say go for things that are things like your potatoes that are easy to grow, or things that grow really quickly, like peas tend to grow really quickly. So there's not too much of a wait between when you put them in the ground and when they actually come up.
But June would be a bit early for potatoes, would it?
Yeah, the thing with the potatoes is you'd have to wait till you come back in September and dig them up then. Or you could put your first earlies in. If you get your potatoes in, sorry, I sound like a gardener now. Get your potatoes in. Get them in February, end of February, beginning of March. They say before St. Patrick's Day, on or before St. Patrick's Day. You won't have big potatoes, but you'll have your salad potatoes before you go home for June. You'll have enough to make little potato wedges for your summer party.
Okay, and does it make a difference whether you go for vegetables or flowers in the garden? Or herbs?
I think it depends on what you prefer, I suppose. But also the added benefit, I suppose, to having herbs and vegetables or fruit is that you've got that extra dimension around food and nutrition that's often helpful to bring into the classroom. I was working in a school down in Kildare where they have a little polytunnel, and every summer for their summer party, the sixth class children cook lunch for everybody in the school. It's only a small school, but they cook lunch for all the other children in the school. And essentially what they have is a salad, because they've grown their own lettuce and salad leaves. They have potato wedges because they've grown their own potatoes. And they have a bowl of soup, which is usually some kind of a vegetable soup, a root vegetable of some kind. But the children take that all the way then from the seed to the plate, and they do all of that cooking themselves. And it's just really impressive. And that can be done. I've seen other schools do it where the children bake apple tarts in the autumn because they've got their apples, or rhubarb, which is another really easy one to do. Rhubarb crumble. So you not only are you learning your skills or your connection around food, but and your cookery skills, but it's also that real kind of autonomous learning that the children get, and that idea that they're that hands-on active learning. So it's great from loads of different perspectives.
And if we go back to the teacher who's building up, say, gradually, so they start off with maybe the pots on the window, and then they progress to the bed, which could be your metre square for the herbs. What would be your next logical step then after that?
Then you could start to think about doing a vegetable patch, where you might have a number of different beds and different things growing in each of the beds. And that gives you a huge variety of learning opportunities. And it also, by growing a variety of things, some things will fail and some things will succeed, and you'll have something to work with. I think that's another really important lesson from the garden, is that things aren't going to fail. Things will get diseased or they'll dry out, and it's okay to make those kind of mistakes. And it's good for children to see that not everything succeeds every time. Thinking about if you've got your four beds, your vegetable patch with four different beds, and you can think about then doing crop rotation between the four beds. I'm thinking of the maths learning that goes into that around designing your four beds and thinking about what goes where and the patterns that go into that, and taking from your two-dimensional design into a three-dimensional space. And then also thinking about your spacings between your plants, and to see children then using their trowels and using their elbows, and they're measuring their arms to space out the plants. So you're thinking they're doing maths and they're not even thinking about that they're doing maths, which is the other really nice thing about the garden, is there's so much learning that's almost like stealth learning, that children are so busy enjoying themselves that they don't even realise that they're doing maths or they're doing science or they're learning. It doesn't feel like learning.
You mentioned trowels there. What other kinds of equipment do you need for a school garden?
You can get away with very little. So I think it's important to have small hand tools like trowels that the children can use. If you're going to do any size of a garden, if you're going to have vegetable beds and things like that, you will need a couple of spades and forks, the larger forks and larger spades, which the older children should be able to use, in fact. And in terms of where to get those, I find a lot of the time what works in a school is if you just put a general shout out to parents, does anybody have a fork sitting at the back of the shed or anything, that will often provide those things. You don't need a huge amount, but it is good to have some basics. A wheelbarrow for moving things around, very important. Also very popular with children. And watering cans. So they would be the basics. And then things like string and sticks, you know, strings and line to measure things out. Other than that, they're the basics. It helps if you talk to your caretaker about having an outdoor water supply. If there's a tap that you can use from outside, very, very nice bonus. If you have access to a hose, that's great as well, but not essential until you get to the bigger gardens, in which case, yeah, you are going to need those kind of things.
And how much of the work should be done by the children and how much should be done by the teacher?
Yes, and that's a thorny issue, essentially. You see all these nature references. You can't see language development, gardens and language development, a huge topic. Ideally, you want the children to do as much of the work as possible. But in fact, in practice, what generally happens is a lot of the maintenance work, if you can pull in a couple of interested teachers or a couple of interested parents who will, or an interested caretaker who has a few moments, often they're very overworked, but to do some of the standard maintenance to keep the garden ticking over, so that when the children come out, they're actually doing things that are very interesting for them. Now, in fairness, children love weeding, particularly if there's competitive elements. So if you're looking for the weed with the biggest leaves or the longest roots, they will love that. But the thing with the children is that maybe their attention spans aren't long enough that, you know, or you don't have enough time with them to really do those general maintenance things. So if you can find a mix of both, which again is why starting small is a good idea, because what can be difficult is if you are given, you know, your principal says, yeah, take over the back garden and that's wonderful and you've loads of space, it can be a huge amount of work, and it can be very off-putting if it gets overgrown or you lose the run of it or you don't have the time to do it. It puts people off completely. Whereas if you start small and you find things that you can do easily and regularly, then that's more encouraging for you. I would say as much as possible, have the children doing, they like things like sowing or planting seedlings or picking fruit or even exploring for insects or mini beasts that might be around that. They might not be as enthralled by just the regular weeding that has to be done. Once in a blue moon it'll get done, but not necessarily. So those general maintenance jobs, if you can pull in an adult, that's handy.
And are there other tasks that you would get children to do then in the garden? I'm trying to think of children who are really enthusiastic about getting involved, and then they go out and they kind of see, well, you know, there's actually not that much to do here. And then it becomes a passive activity for them.
There's always something to do. Yes, but it is. And I suppose that's a thing with management as well. If you have a lot of children out, not everyone is going to be digging at the same time. Not everyone will be able to plant at the same time. So it's thinking of those other jobs, which might be simple things like tying in your peas or if you've got climbers, tying those in. I would always have children looking to see if they can find predators like ladybirds. So making sure you've got plenty of ladybirds and you can move them off your rose bushes and onto your vegetable plants. Or checking if there are pests. So if there are lots of green fly or lots of caterpillars. Again, caterpillars can be removed. Green fly, you might want to give them a squirt with some soapy water. I'm trying to think of other things that the children can be doing. I would usually have a group of children worm charming at some point.
What's worm charming?
If you notice, a lot of the time birds, I see it a lot with seagulls, they'll be tapping their feet on the ground. And what that does, nobody's quite sure why, but we think it's probably that worms think it's raining and they come up to the surface. So you can charm earthworms up to the surface in a variety of different ways. And you can experiment with different ways of charming them, either with your feet or maybe you can, if you stick a fork in the ground and twang it. And then you can just observe the health of your soil. So it's a way of looking at how healthy your soil is. If you've got lots of earthworms, you can take them up and you can examine the earthworms, see what they're like, see who's got the longest earthworm, and then put them back either in the ground or on your compost heap. So collecting up dead leaves and putting them in compost, having a compost heap is also really useful. And in fact, a lot of schools do have compost bins or compost heaps because they're working towards the green flags. So that ties in with that whole programme as well.
In most schools, do you find, is it one teacher who kind of takes an interest and that's where it starts? Or would you have a particular class that would take care of the school gardener? How does it, you know, what kind of arrangements do you find in schools?
So recently I've been looking at schools that have had long-term school gardens and looking at how do they make it work? Because that was a question, how do you make a school garden work? And the common factors I have noticed is, one, if you have a school principal who's supportive of the project, that makes all the difference because it does take time and commitment. You need to have at least one teacher who is going to drive things forward. That might be the school principal or it might be another teacher in the school. But it does really help if there's a couple of teachers who are, there might be one teacher that takes the lead, but if they have the support of the other teachers in the school, that really makes a difference. A lot of the schools I spoke to, they have a garden committee, which might be a couple of teachers and some of the children in the older classes, maybe the fifth and sixth classes, or it might overlap with their Green Schools committee. But it helps then to have that kind of a group of interested people, adults and children, who give each other support and then can encourage other people to get involved. So a lot of the schools I spoke with, they will have all of their classes involved at some point. And I think that's a really nice thing to do. Because what it means is that children might start off when they're in junior or senior infants doing very small things in the garden. But as they progress, by the time they're in fifth and sixth class, they are expert gardeners. And they are used to being outside. They know what needs to be done. And it just forms this seamless part of their life. And it may be only 1 or 2 days a year. There's one school I work with where the children just come out, they have a parent who's very involved and he keeps the garden ticking over, and the children just come out on the harvest days and they harvest the fruit and the vegetables and then everybody gets something to take home. And that's their involvement, and they know the garden is there and they come out and look at it occasionally, but that's their hands-on involvement, and that works for that school. There's another school where the children come out and from the time they're in junior infants and they're doing the garden centre as one of their ASHTR projects to, you know, they come out at their lunchtimes to do their watering. They have free rein of the garden. So again, it's throughout the school. And then there's another school that focuses maybe just the third and fourth classes will come out once a week maybe to work in the garden. It's about finding what works for you. There's no one right way. And I think that's an important message to get across. There's no one way to do things. There's no one size fits all for a garden. It's to find what works for you. If you're interested, there are ways to make it work.
And can there be a situation where maybe the soil quality or the location isn't so good? Maybe it's in a very damp area, or there's no sun getting in, or the soil just doesn't have many nutrients in it. Can that happen? And if so, what can you do about those kind of things?
There are always going to be challenges, no matter where you are. If you're on the coast and so it's very salty, or whether you're in an area that gets a lot of frost, the classic one is poor soil. And that's an easy one to solve, because then you garden in pots and in tubs.
Using compost.
And you use compost, yeah, exactly. So that's an easy one to get over. More challenging might be if you're in a place that gets very little light, or you're in a place that's really damp and wet. And the challenge there is to find the couple. There will always be something that will grow and will grow happily. And it's to find those things. So I know your next question is, well, where do you go for that kind of advice, or where do you go to find those things?
Yeah, because, I mean, like, because you have a horticultural background, whereas most teachers won't have that.
Yes, and I don't think it's fair to ask teachers to turn themselves into horticultural experts. So the good news is that there's lots of advice out there. There are lots of resources out there for you to use. Our own Paddy Madden is a great man who has come up with some wonderful books around going wild at school and the school garden through the year. So there's some great ideas. One of my personal favourites, and I don't think it gets enough promotion, Boardbia, about 5 years ago, came out with a whole programme called Organic Gardening for Schools. There's a book available, but it's also downloadable from the web as a PDF. There's a DVD, but also little video blogs that you can download from the web that will go through all of the aspects of building and maintaining a school garden and a wildlife area. So there's a huge amount of information there, from the different things that you can grow and what will suit different areas best, to lesson plans that you can work with whatever year, there'll be a variety of different years, to the kind of resources that you'll need, and then even just ideas for what you could put into your garden. A little wildlife area is always a lovely thing to have in a garden.
And on next week's programme, we'll hear some of Sandra Austin's ideas about how you can create a wildlife area in your garden. Sandra teaches social, environmental and scientific education at the Merino Institute of Education in Dublin. To download hundreds of Inside Education podcasts, go to seandelaney.com. But until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.